Blog Talk Radio.
Good day and hello to everyone out there that's tuned into Masonic Effects. It's a pleasure to have you here. You notice that sometimes it's the littlest things that can satisfy the most. Eh? The things that normally wouldn't even occur to us. But for some reason, they register. And the gesture of kindness or ruthlessness, the sense of fatigue that we experience, this feeling of too much, it does speak to one of the values of our clear-minded people, moderation. Moderation in how you define it, how I define it will be slightly different, but we know what it is we're speaking about. And we know that it produces a caution, doesn't it? And after all, as Freemasons, we want to thrive and want to progress, but do so cautiously. We've watched the Crowley's and his acolytes dive off into the deep end and exploring. I mean, I don't think we were all totally pleased with the personality. It tended to overshadow the findings. I think, to me, it's a small, when I think of that, I think of it as the small dose of the doctors that were at work in the early 40s doing very diabolical surgical experiments on live humans and claiming that the findings were able to enrich medicine and science for all humanity. In other words, if we can get over our fear of the dehumanizing the empathy and compassion for our fellow man, there's much to be learned. But I think I'd rather live in ignorance until I can find that information. And it will be found by another means, by the means that allows me to respect the life around me and not lose part of my soul in the endeavor. That kind of notion and explanation has been the worst kind of rationalizations. Pathetic. But that wasn't invented by those folks, and it certainly, how far back we can trace it, well, I think largely we don't want to trace it. We don't like to trace it. It's there. It's a stain. So all of that aside, the connections that we make provide us with context. And I think repeatedly we find evidence that might connect in our minds with the thinking of with us thinking of realizing the work of the Buddha. Yeah, didn't his father want to protect him and keep him so satisfied with every indulgence that he would never want for anything, that he would be completely safe and satisfied in his own existence? I connect that with Plato's cave, the reality of the people inside the cave that don't look beyond the horizon is real to them. Is that reality? But no, if it's fair to say, we in some ways struggled to climb out of that cave. But Buddha, before he was called the Buddha, was in that state, in that cave. And then when he did go out, when he was traveling, when he was being transported from one location to another, he saw things. He saw the reality of life for a lot of people. He saw poverty. He saw degradation. He saw pain and suffering. And that too becomes part of reality. But rather than be transfixed by that, be absorbed by that, or defined by, well, maybe we'll come to that. Is that what defined him? In balance, what we know is that this was a piece of missing insight. And we, big step, of course, trace his development, the insight of the Buddha, awareness of all, the singularity to that process. At least some history tells us that, or alludes to that. And I like to think that in some way we can borrow from that story and apply those ideas to our own lives and to this amazing brotherhood that we've joined. Like to think that along that way, we have a practical side and a fanciful side. We'll have a conscious awareness. We'll be rubbing shoulders with solipsism, but we will also be with people who have a spiritual comfort. And we'll have the confusion. Where do I put the theoretical physicists, where do I put them? Practical or conceptual? Yeah, but drawing on the subconscious. Mm-hmm. And then along comes this awareness. What does this do for me or with me, or should it do anything for me? What does it do to my thinking? What is it doing to my thinking? And I like that. I like the idea that we're being encouraged to do that through the, and not to be smug about it, but when we think about these connections, it puts Freemasonry in a different context. And I have in mind that the image of the Kabbalist tree of life, and at times I can look at what we are about globally as this root system, but at other times I can see it as these branches absorbing these leaves, absorbing all this energy, and transforming it. It speaks loudly to two important themes of Masonry. This is important for some, this transformation. Not so easy when you start off at ground zero. The whole idea of this rebirth, I think, is very, very difficult. Starting again as a grown man, that's a difficult challenge. Not everybody is up to it, but not up to it in the way that I think it should be. Huh? What if they're up to it in the way that they think that it should influence them? And so we have the celebration of diversity within some measure of propriety, and we have enough information to help us with that, to help us understand the common language, the mannerisms that are expected of us and mannerisms that aren't, that we want to that don't define this sense of the dignity of our history and our achievements. That alone hasn't changed whether we're completely absorbed in this lifestyle, or whether we have tinkered with the curiosity and the questioning and reason continuously. We have a sense of purpose. Not because you and I might feel it, but because of optics, we're never, those connections are all together, all very important connections. We're not ever in a situation alone. We're always moving forward through this space, through this ether. We can tie ourselves to history. Some people are good, very, very happy doing that, because it's filling in a piece in the puzzle. Do you and I link to 14th, 15th, 16th century thinking? Well, we can't really answer that until we explore that for ourselves. And we begin usually by listening to other people help us. That is very important. Well, then we examine it for ourselves and determine for ourselves whether the claim is in any way applicable. Or is it contextual? And along the way, we're going to experience the very real annoyances of life. And that just seems to happen more and more when we lose track of our bearing, of our presence. Other than that, when we do things with presence of mind, we're very much observing. We're very much selecting, very much even conscious of the effects of things going on around us, things said to us, and personalities on our own. And we can, horror of horrors, we can begin to make choices about what triggers us, what is information that we'll store. We store a lot of information. What tells us more about the people around us or the speaker than about our own reaction? Now, today, I've drawn out a poet that has been intimidating for me for a long, long time, William Blake. And I'm reading about this very, very interesting man. He was, of course, not as recognized, like many very smart people. He wasn't as recognized during his life as since. when we can, it's like Shakespeare at the time he was known, but after we have a chance to examine and savor the work, that early interest didn't go away. And as we grew in numbers, so did that influence. So was it different or the same, just proportional, just changes in proportion? Well, let's do the, I think the proportion, my concern, my caution around the work of William Blake was the way that it was described to me. He was a great thinker, and who was took art, challenging art, and he blended them. He was a painter, and he was a printmaker, and he was a poet. And he was questioning, and he was what we know about the little about the guy tells us that he was on a path. He was looking into the questions, those existential questions. He was looking at the redefining the relationship of a human, of him, with the creator. And he was, we know some things about him that truly do define. So I had a sense that I would be completely overwhelmed by the work of and I would feel quite inadequate, as I often do, trying to understand the point of the man. And then I'll tell you, illustrate connections. I had purchased a copy of a work of Freemasonry, The Reality by Tobias Churton. And you, a theologist and very, very ample kind of thinker, very confident kind of thinker. He goes into questions with a vengeance, just amazing. And I looking through bibliography, I noticed that Churton had written a book on William Blake. It's titled Jerusalem. Is a well-known, one of the well-known poems and themes of that came from Blake's work. And so I begin to read it and find that this was a person just like you and I, with a background that was his own and unique as his, and just like you and I, we have our own uniqueness. And he went about developing and being influenced by ideas. And my goodness, the ideas were the ideas that influenced him seemed to be curious, make me curious, and wanted to know more. I wanted to understand those bits. And so we come to presenting a poem that he wrote a very great long time ago called London. And it is for me reminiscent of the journey of the Buddha, that the Buddha experienced until he sat down in the dust and heat of the day to think about what was happening, what had been happening around him. But I, for some reason, it wasn't with this sense of being overwhelmed or what's the point? You know, life is too short. I want to be happy and gay and not look into the abyss. I don't want to look at the seriousness. I don't want to acknowledge that the pain of poverty exists, for example, or that inequality exists. It's a big, big question. I don't want to know that. So I won't look there, huh? But that's not what we describe. That's not what we want to do because it's inconsistent. It creates doing that and then claiming that we're trying to progress is inconsistent. And I'm being reminded that I'm thinking here of the fear that I've stopped processing information and reasoning through, and I've succumbed to opinion. Just drawn a line. This is the opinion about that, regardless of the circumstance or the uniqueness going on. This is my opinion about that, and that, and that. And that is not how the world disconnects from me, but how I disengage. And maybe that is something that gives comfort when I think about the person who has been scarred intellectually and emotionally by whatever, or burdened by the bleakness of their upbringing or their grasp of what's going on, the way that they translate it. Here we can introduce some alternatives. Eh? Always a choice. Always a choice. And Masonry does that quite well. But it's not alone. There's other sources, but none that I've found that are so audacious in pointing to a study of religion, an awareness of politics. The recovery of the subconscious without denying practicality and consciousness itself. Not a doctrine, but a process. And at the end of it, it takes us into, we found a long time ago that equality was important. So, of course, democracy. But we know that that is chaotic, isn't it? Because we're going to have the clamor and the question, how do we ever get anything done? Well, if you think that there were thousands of people at the Socrates trial, yeah, and there's a strong likelihood that some of the people there in the jury, it's not just there, that was the size of the jury, couldn't hear what he had to say, and Beat were charged with making the decision about the penalty for his transgressions. We think that he elected. He had input into his penalty, and it wasn't necessarily that there was a bloodlust out there, but such is democracy, that there is a clamor. Keep the perspective on it. Always the question, how do you do anything? How could you possibly get anything done? And the answer is that's not the important part of democracy. It's the importance is how we get there, and that connectivity, that feeling of inclusion. I have a responsibility. I'll quarrel about that. You know, yes, I'll quarrel. I don't want that responsibility. I'm fed up with the system, so I'm not going to participate. But even that, I'm participating. The narrative is always there, the politics that, you know, that it's always the village. When we're talking about politics like that, it's always at the village level. What's got our attention today here and how we define it, that village? Do I define it as the streets around me in the city? And the people that I know and the person that delivers my newspaper, or do I think of this more in terms of the culture that I experience, that is familiar to me? And when we do ask ourselves these questions, wherever we are, we will always be seeing the ideal. We see the way that life is supposed to be, and over on this periphery, we see the reality, and that gives us that ring to chase, that gold ring, to bring about. Could we live? We've chewed away at Thomas More. We understand the progress of utopia, and then how to live with it. Well, do we chip away at that and find ways that we can tolerate the utopia, tolerate the means to get to utopia, what we have to do, the compromise, and feel good about it? Well, you've heard me before liken this to the work of, rather than, you know, soldiers in rank. If you've ever been in any type of military service, you will know that I enjoyed that at the time. I quite enjoyed it, because it is, it's a new defining experience, having that. A role in a process, a very clear as clear as can be, the way we what we take and what we take away and how it shapes us, that's about our what we can attend to around us, what shapes your personality, in other words, and intelligence plays a role. And that isn't the, you know, I like to think that masonry is going to fuel that ripple, this sense of intelligent conversation, the depth of intelligent conversation. But then again, not if we've... I was raised where intelligence was simply a measure of what we could memorize. Yeah. It seems that we've redefined that lately. The connections go on all of the, and we're going to talk more about that during the show today. So I hope you enjoy it. I think there's enough in it that you'll find satisfying. So fill up your espresso or your cup of tea, or if you're more so inclined, that glass of port or maybe Pernod. Here, Bill Evans. What did you see? What did you feel? Eh? Normally, Billy Evans is so melodic and gentle. And he resolves. His music resolves the discord, but not in that. The title of that was NYC is No Lark, New York City. Mm-hmm. Connections all around us all the time, and yet we have these if we put the question to ourselves, are we unique? We are in some way. In that moment in time, we are unique because we can cast our minds back in a way. We allow ourselves to filter through history. We don't. Can you imagine? Are the only, if you said, Dale, tell me about your background, Graham, but then I could only answer you if I was aware of all of it. Well, we filter. I'm not one of those interesting people that have total recall, partial recall. But I now know that recall is also a process of sequencing and retrieval. So how much more information is stored in there? A lot. Here, while we have connections forward and around us, we can also look at Masonry as giving us this, creating this state of becoming. And anticipation. There's something ahead of us. And here's some influences. Here's quite a few influences, and they're deep. So they will test you as far as you need go, or as you're capable. The tests. We're always in that state of being. And the word that describes this state, it's uncomfortable. In a way, it is, you could say, it has to do with ambivalence. You know, that's fence sitting. And I've been ambivalence has been a frequent visitor in my practice for many, many years. So I entitled this the liminal state, the state of becoming, the struggle. If how we come together depends on the attention and care we place on those conversations with Masonic curious men, people, I want to think those conversations reflect prevailing attitudes of a lodge that has had those conversations. Rigid, doctrinaire, don't seem to do us justice, but we continue to struggle to find balance by knowing and mindset of a particular lodge brotherhood. There's a collective. We can reflect on it individually, but we also have a sense of the collective. Too much of one and too little of the other sets us on a wobbly orbit. How do we find balance? It is a search. We know balance lies somewhere ahead of us in our collective future. Because we are an initiatory brotherhood, we are presented with ritual that needs to be taught to each entered apprentice, ideally in a study group, in which he is able to explore his own thinking while absorbing new information. Becoming a learner is first in the mind, becoming excited about possibilities. Where do we find that? How do we know it? Without the conviviality and fellowship, without order and decorum, where profound social differences are mediated and allowed for, a place where men are rewarded for virtue by working an ideology that justifies equality. That kind of lodge operates with consistency provided by guardrails, principles, and ethics. What you and I draw from Freemasonry that we apply to our own transformative, you know, that good to better kind of thinking, you may believe is as unique as opinion. Like there's no accounting for taste. Everybody has their own. So sit down, put your cane away. Your temper doesn't matter. Everybody has their own opinion, even about silliness. What you and I draw from Freemasonry that we apply to our own transformative sense is unique. Or you might believe it is the point of Masonry to bring this together so that we can find ourselves, redefine ourselves. Always and forever, there is a tension living in a liminal state. Draw what comfort you might from the fact that you are not alone. Does it matter? Somebody's angst over there, what does it matter? You have your own. And meanwhile, we're in a state of becoming encouraged by the beauty and talent of brethren around us. And for that, we are fortunate. Is this change or discovering secrets we've hidden in our psyche? How much of it is change? Let me know what works for you. Because we're all at different points at different times. Knowing that is identifying ourselves and each other, this cohort, as students. Beautiful. Thank you. This is a fellow that was writing music to Etta James. Yeah, Houston Pearson. Beautiful. Beautiful. That, of course, is Since I Fell in Love with You. Where to begin with this poet? Where do we begin? You know, it's curious that we can today, with a few keystrokes, I can bring up history, and yet the depth, I can bring up information. The depth of it depends on a couple of things. It depends on the question that I ask or you ask, and I've discovered that I am able to recreate that feeling that I had as a student long, long ago when I was in the library. Oh, it was ridiculous. I would go in for a particular title. You know, the professor would give us a reading list, and everybody is doing their research, or you had a paper to write. How many times, I can't tell you how many times I walked through the library and to be distracted by and the first time I was in the smell of the books and having a professional staff of librarians around to assist your research who had an interest in your work, my goodness, who could carry conversation about parts of it, of course, but not quite as depth, but who else? You know, you don't find this walking around the street. This is wonderful. That is the overwhelming sense of the information. I was such a gadfly. Turn around and there's a title, the back of a book behind me that on a sort of, you know, how the libraries were organized in the day. Finding something that was compelling. And I didn't necessarily realize at the time that doing that, did I have the ability to connect what that was, that apparent randomness with the purpose that brought me to the library in the first place, time and time again. And so now I find, you know, my lovely wife just gave me a copy of Nicholas Nickleby. Here I am at my age, the other side of 70, getting into the classics that I didn't as a boy or as a young man. Fabulous still. But it's not this randomness. It's just the sense that it makes. And here the poet today, William Blake, helps not an overwhelming dude, but the question is that I've been asked, was he a Freemason? And yes, they're making declarations. They have dates here. It was first degree, second, blah, 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 and on and on and on. You know the drill. But I tend to question that because a little more learned. Yeah, there might have been a Billy Blake that was a Mason or a William Blake. I'm sure there's more than one, but not to cast aspersions. I think the nature, the if you read about this man, what we read about is a personality. We're seeing information that draws out a character, a personality over time. Do we want to be around this? Was this person thoughtful? Were they aggressive? You know, all those types of things that we try and extrapolate through history. And I think this man was very much the individual, but he was curious. He was a curious fellow. And I'm sitting here with a copy of a very short history of the Swedenborg Society that I recommend. This one's by Richard Lines, Lines. I very much recommend this for your reading. If for no other reason, then it tells you about a very curious development in late 18th century Britain. The Swedenborg Society, it was in continuous existence for 200 years. And the purpose remains as it was when it was founded, to still exist, to translate, publish, print, distribute, and sell the religious writings of Emanuel Swedenborg. And he lived between 1688 and 1772. So quite this fellow, this Swedish scientist and philosopher and theologian, and get this, the seer. You can imagine who he would rub shoulders with by attending and understanding the translations of Swedenborg's Latin texts, the theologian. Yeah. So you would find George Pritchard, John Close, and John Augustus Tulk. Yes, that one, the society's first chairman, and his son Charles, and Samuel Taylor Coleridge, and yeah, John Close, and so many more. He was a member of parliament for Sudbury and for Poole later. So he was involved. I'll just leave you at this. You do what you have to or you must with that. Blake is born in 1757. And he died in 1827. And the description is just lovely. An English engraver, artist, poet, and visionary. And I'm reading from Britannica here. Author of exquisite lyrics. And writer. He etched, printed, colored, stitched, and sold his work with the assistance of a devoted wife. He was born over his father's modest hosiery shop. I always like those stories because it's familiar. And I always think when I hear that, it's, those folks had advantages I never had. Oh. The work here that I'm going to get into, he wrote many, many, many poems that are widely read and studied. But the one that we're going to focus on today, London, is possibly the most famous of all of his work. And it was published in 1794 in a volume of his work, Songs of Experience. And this was written to offer a flip side to the positive transcendent message present in his earlier work, Songs of Innocence. But as you read through it, tell me, do you sense what do you sense? Do you sense that affiliation? If the philosophy of Immanuel Kant is now studied worldwide, wasn't it in the day, the current climate of philosophical investigation ignores the mystical thinker Immanuel Swedenborg, at best relegating him to footnote status. But towards the end of the 18th century, the interest in Swedenborg among intellectuals was immense. His writings made a lot of noise in the speculative world. As the leading journal of esoteric matters, the Conjurer's Magazine commented in 1791. Kant even felt compelled to respond to Swedenborg in his writing Dreams of a Spirit Seer. And Swedenborg's teaching became the main substance of the occult revival of the late 18th century. And his ideas have had a lasting appeal as a source of inspiration for many intellectuals who were not converts. Goethe, Lavater, Coleridge, Emerson, Balzac, Baudelaire, Whitman, Melville, Henry James, you get the list. And not least, the poet and painter William Blake. The Swedenborg Church is the only religious institution that he attended. So, got it? That's the guy. That's the guy. The speaker in this poem is a short poem. The speaker takes a walk through the designated streets of London. And as you're walking along, I'd like you to think about how this information, rather than just transfixed on the what else is going on in the mind, how this piece of information, how this piece of processing fits, and you'll naturally make the connection with your own thoughts. And this is a fellow walking near the Thames, which seems to have its course dictated, for it flows throughout the city. The speaker sees signs of resignation and sadness in the faces of every person that passes by, and he hears this pain in the cries men, as well as those of fearful newborn babies. You see, you're talking about vulnerability. What's more vulnerable than a newborn baby, and what's more vulnerable than a man? And in fact, in every voice in the city and every law or restriction London places on its population, the speaker can sense people's feelings of being oppressed by city life. So here he goes, here's the cry of a young chimney sweeps who, and the misery brings shame on the church authorities. How can the juxtaposition make that? I don't want to get into that here. And thinking of unfortunate British soldiers dying in vain, and speaker imagines their blood running down the walls of a palace. So a graffiti artist, he's painting the graffiti, paints in his mind. But most of all, the speaker hears the midnight cries of young prostitutes who swear and curse at their situation. In turn, this miserable sound brings misery to their tearful newborn children. And the speaker imagines this sound plaguing what the speaker calls the marriage hearse, a surreal imagined vehicle that carries love and death together. I wandered through each chartered street near where the chartered Thames does flow, and mark in every face I meet marks of weakness, marks of woe. In every cry of every man, in every infant's cry of fear, in every voice, in every ban, the long-forged manacles I hear. How the chimney sweepers cry, every blackened church appalls, and the hapless soldier's sigh runs in blood down palace walls. But most through midnight streets I hear how the youthful harlots curse, blasts the newborn infant's tear, and blights with plagues the marriage hearse. Better that I just put head in sand and pretend. Better that I pretend, because, oh my goodness, I don't know how that piece fits in to the fabric. It's real. It's reality. How do I move forward? And by the way, at some point we're going to look in the mirror and be wondering what kind of person we really are. Who am I? It wasn't just the Greeks. This is somewhere they picked that idea up. And don't you want to have, don't you like to think that you might be able to influence the answer to that question? So you're not a pretender, a fake. I just turned away. Ego on the run. My goodness. Listen to us getting all in depth and making connections. Who would have thought? Thank you. Seemed to, I needed that. It's like a palate cleanser, just to prepare for the next portion of the meal after tucking into William Blake. Let's be frank. We have the give and take, that dynamic. Lodges are dynamics, and the dynamics between the personalities, between the issues, whether you've got the energy to or not, whether you just show up tired and you're overwhelmed by the emotion of the situation, you know, all those things. Is it transcendent? Are you in an atmosphere that has been so carefully curated to enhance the experience? I like to think of that when I'm putting this kind of thought front and center for me. I like to think that it's akin to producers of grand opera have in mind, that the performance, the care, the detail is so exquisite, that it's so elegant, that it creates that atmosphere. If you want to think of a mental image of elegance and sophistication, what do you conjure? If I'm talking to a pantheist there, everything that I see in nature is God. Yes, okay, I'm perfectly fine with that. But when I'm putting on my suit, I'm going out the door with my wife with good tickets. I like the middle of the theater, so, you know, not really close to the orchestra pit. And we will have a glass of wine before, you know, it's normal. Get there a little early and walk around and see the buzz and feel the energy. And then curtain rise. You know, we hear the overture elegance, and then after, go to dinner to talk about what we've experienced. I don't think I have the answer for everybody, but it gives you a sense of what I need. We're going to talk about here very quickly the early days of the Masonic fraternity. On the continent, the historian is telling us, they were plagued with disputes, but at the time they were engendered largely by ecclesiastical authorities, Protestant, and Nijmegen and Catholic. Yes, my goodness. But controversy was never solely the work of anti-Masonic publicists external to the lodges. The task of establishing these new constitutionally governed societies also brought with it crises over legitimacy and authority, and not least over national identity as the fraternity spread far and wide from the London Grand Lodge. The records of Dutch Freemasonry once again richly illustrate this phenomena. They permit us to watch the tensions and uncertainties of the fraternal participants in this new and unique form of social and political behavior. As one example, let's focus on the disagreements that arose between the most historically important Grand Lodge, Dutch Lodge, located in Amsterdam and called after, it was renamed after 1754 and called Le Bien Ami, and we've talked about that before on the show, and the Grand Lodge of The Hague. Tensions. Comme à quelle woven into the disputes were issues about the nature of true Masonic government and more precisely about the validity or legitimacy of the Masonic Constitution. The new lodges, both in Britain and the continent, were never simply private fraternal societies. They were also, as in the case in the Dundee Lodge that we read about earlier, constitutionally governed and legitimized civil societies. Predictably, within their private deliberations can also be found overtones of larger national and international issues about which brothers appear to have had deep disagreement. In the microcosmic polity constituted in a lodge, values and issues drawn from the larger society were debated and negotiated. Social place and rank were adjudicated, and the nature of authority was questioned and resolved. Let's say temporarily. But in the Dutch lodges, events in the political experience of the Republic at mid-century played into, exacerbated, and possibly even at moments caused this atmosphere of internal controversy. The records of Le Bien Ami, as well as other Dutch lodges, permit us to reconstruct the fluidity between the private and public, just as they also reveal the tensions between the desire for orderly Masonic government and the autonomy of individual lodges. It's that balance, between obedience to the national authority and rebellion against it. And here, I thought that I was being quite original. So, we wrap it up for today. I hope it's been, I hope it helped make connections with you and through you with other aspects of masonry, the ideas. It's limitless. Thank you for taking a moment to settle in. I think there's some comfort knowing that, you know, the tensions and the dynamics are inherent to the structure, the kind of structure that we're in. It's so much easier to point a finger and reframe our problems in terms of personality, because it's easier to resolve, you know, just shoo the person away. But as we can see from the material, that the fuel for Masonic effects, the flame continues to burn, the light continues to burn. Hundreds of years later, here we are with these dynamics still in play. And I would begin to think that there's some law of dynamics sitting here amongst us that we've been unable to identify. I hope that you'll take a moment and reflect, and that this has given you a pause to move ahead in your own inquiries and make your own connections. And my goodness, perhaps even look at yourself in a more enhanced way. And that said, this is a never-ending conversation that just doesn't happen without you, without you giving this purpose. I am enormously grateful for supporters from all over the world, for your attention and your diligence. Eh? I hope to see you next week on the program. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. Include yourself in that if you don't mind. Be kind. I'm drawn to when I was part of a pipe ceremony years ago. Here's a bit of disclosure. I was brought into the Iron Band, part of the Cree Nation, by elders who were visiting and helping me out, personally helping me out, and others, in Yellowknife, Canada, way up in the Arctic. And the messaging was that you have other purpose. You have other purpose. There's other things yet to do. And so true. So true. So come back and we'll continue. Enjoy. Here's the rest of Keith Jarrett for you. Thanks. Thank you.